After leaving the collector's house, Zheng Beihai took the meteorites to a modelling workshop in a research institute belonging to the Space Force. Work had let out and the workshop, which contained a state-of-the-art CNC mill, was empty. First, he used the mill to slice the three meteorites into cylinders of equal diameter, about the thickness of a pencil lead, and then cut them into small segments of equal length. He worked very carefully, trying to minimize waste as much as possible, and ended up with 36 small meteorite rods. When this was done, he carefully collected the cutting debris, removed the special blade he had selected for cutting the stone from the machine, and then left the workshop. The remainder of the work he conducted in a secret basement. He set 36 7.62mm pistol cartridges on the table before him and removed each projectile in turn. If they had been old-style brass cartridges, this would have required a lot of effort, but 2 years ago the entire military had updated its standard guns to use caseless ammunition, whose projectile was glued directly to the propellant and was easy to detach. Next, he used a special adhesive to affix a meteorite rod onto each propellant. The adhesive, originally developed to repair the skin of space capsules, ensured that the bond would not fail in the extreme hot and cold temperatures of space. In the end, he had 36 meteorite bullets. He inserted 4 meteorite bullets into a magazine, which he then loaded into a P-224 pistol and fired at a sack in the corner. The gunshot was deafening in the narrow basement room and left behind a strong scent of gunpowder. He carefully examined the 4 holes in the sack, noting that they were small, which meant that the meteorite had not shattered upon firing. He opened the sack and withdrew a large hunk of fresh beef, and with a knife carefully extracted the meteorite that had penetrated it. The 4 meteorite rods had shattered completely, leaving a small pile of rubble that he poured onto his palm. It showed practically no sign of having been worked. This outcome satisfied him. The sack that held the beef was made out of materials used in spacesuits. To make the simulation even more realistic, it had been arranged in layers that sandwiched insulation sponges, plastic tubing, and other material. He carefully packed up the remaining 32 meteorite bullets and exited the basement, heading off to make preparations for his visit to space. Zheng Beihai hung in space 5 kilometers out from Yellow River Station, a wheel-shaped space station that lay 300 kilometers above the space elevator terminus as a counterweight. It was the largest structure humanity had ever constructed in space, and it could house over 1,000 long-term residents. The region of space within a 500-kilometer radius of the space elevator was home to other space facilities, all of them much smaller than Yellow River Station and scattered about like the nomadic tents that dotted the prairie during the opening of the American West. These formed the prelude of humanity's large-scale entrance into space. The shipyards that had just commenced construction were the largest yet and would eventually cover an area 10 times greater than Yellow River Station. But right now, all that had been put up was scaffolding that looked like the skeleton of a leviathan. Zheng Beihai had come from Base 1, a separate space station 80 kilometers away and just 1/5 the size of Yellow River Station, the Space Force's base in geostationary orbit. He had been living and working with the other members of the first special contingent of future reinforcements for 3 months now, and had only been back to Earth once. At Base 1, he had been waiting for an opportunity, and now an opportunity presented itself. The aerospace faction was holding a high-level work conference on Yellow River Station, and all three of his targets for elimination would be attending. Once Yellow River Station went into operation, aerospace had held quite a few meetings there, as if to make up for the regrettable fact that most of the people in the aerospace sector had never gotten the chance to go to space. Before leaving Base 1, Zheng Beihai had dropped his spacesuit's positioning unit in his own cabin so the surveillance system would not be aware that he had left the base and there would be no record of his movements. Using the thrusters on his suit, he flew 80 kilometers through space to the position he had selected. Then he waited. The meeting was over, but he was waiting for the participants to come out and take a group photo. It was a tradition for all meeting participants to take a group photo in space. Usually, the photograph would be taken against the sun, because that was the only way to get a clear shot of the space station. Since every person in the group shot had to turn their helmet visors to transparent to expose their face during the photo, they would have to keep their eyes shut against the sun's intense rays if they faced it, not to mention the fact that the inside of their helmets would get intolerably hot. So the best time for a group shot was when the sun was just about to rise or fall over the horizon of the Earth. In geosynchronous orbit, one sunrise and one sunset took place every 24 hours, although the night was very short. Zheng Beihai was waiting for the sun to set. He knew that Yellow River Station's surveillance system was able to detect his presence, but that wouldn't attract any attention. As the point of origin for space development, the region was littered with construction materials, both unused and abandoned, as well as an even greater quantity of garbage. Much of this floating material was roughly the size of a human. Moreover, the space elevator and the surrounding facilities had a relationship like a metropolis and its surrounding villages, with the supplies for the latter coming entirely from the former, so traffic between them was quite busy. As people became used to the environment of space, they gradually adopted the habit of crossing solo. Using spacesuits as a sort of space bicycle, with thrusters that could push them to speeds of up to 500 kilometers per hour, was the easiest means of travel within a few hundred kilometers of the space elevator. By this point, people were flying between the space elevator and the surrounding stations all the time. But right now, Zheng Beihai knew the surrounding space was empty. Apart from the Earth, which was visible as a complete sphere from geosynchronous orbit, and the sun, about to dip below its edge, everything in all directions was pitch-black abyss, and the myriad stars were shining dust that was powerless to alter the emptiness of the universe. He knew that his suit's life support system would only hold up for 12 hours, and before that time ran out, he had to make it 80 kilometers back to Base 1. Now, just a shapeless point far off in the distance of the abyss of space. The base itself would not survive very long either if it left the umbilical cord of the space elevator, but now, as he floated in the vast void, he felt like his contact with the blue world down below had been cut off. He was an independent presence in the universe, unattached to any world, dangling in the cosmos, no ground beneath his feet and surrounded by empty space on all sides with no origin or destination, like the Earth, the Sun, and the Milky Way. He simply existed, and he liked this feeling. He even sensed that his father's departed spirit might share this very same feeling. The sun made contact with the edge of the Earth. Zheng Beihai raised one hand. The glove of his suit held a telescopic sight which he used to observe one of Yellow River Station's exits, 10 kilometers distant. On the large curved metal exterior wall, the round airlock door was still sealed. He turned his head toward the sun, which had now set halfway and looked like a glittering ring atop the earth. Looking back through the scope at the station, this time he saw that the beacon light next to the exit had turned from red to green, indicating that the air inside the airlock had been emptied. Immediately afterward, the hatch slid open and a group of figures wearing white spacesuits filed out. There were about 30 of them. As they flew off in a group, the shadow they cast on the outer wall of Yellow River Station expanded. They had to fly a considerable distance to fit the entire station into frame. But before long, they slowed down and began their weightless lineup under the photographer's direction. By now, the sun had sunk by two-thirds. The remainder looked like a luminous object inlaid into the earth above a smooth sea mirror that was half blue and half orange-red, its top covered by sun-soaked clouds that looked like pink feathers. As the light dropped in intensity, the people in the distant group photo began to turn their visors transparent, revealing the faces in the helmets. Zheng Beihai increased his scope's focal length and quickly found his targets. Just as he had expected, due to their rank, they were in the centre of the front row. He released the scope, leaving it suspended in front of him, and with his left hand he twisted the metal retaining ring of his right glove to detach it. Now that his right hand was wearing just a thin cloth glove, he immediately felt the -100-degree temperature of space. So to avoid a quick freeze, he turned his body to an angle that let the weak sunlight shine on his hand. He extended the hand into a side pocket of his suit and withdrew a pistol and two magazines. Then, with his left hand, he grasped the floating scope and affixed it to the pistol. The scope had been a rifle sight that he had modified with a magnetic attachment so it could be used on a pistol. The vast majority of firearms on Earth could shoot in space. The vacuum was not a problem because the bullet's propellant contained its own oxidizer, but you did need to worry about the temperature of space. Both extremes differed greatly from atmospheric temperatures and had the potential to affect the gun and ammunition, so he was afraid to leave the pistol and magazines exposed for too long. To shorten that time, over the past 3 months, he had drilled repeatedly in taking out the gun, mounting the sight, and changing magazines. He started to aim, and captured his first target in the crosshairs of the scope. In Earth's atmosphere, even the most sophisticated sniper rifles couldn't hit a target at a distance of 5 kilometers, but an ordinary pistol could in space. The bullets moved in a zero-gravity vacuum, free of any outside interference, so as long as their aim was true, they would follow an extremely stable trajectory directly to the target. Zero air resistance, meanwhile, meant that the bullets would not decelerate during flight and would strike the target with the initial muzzle velocity, ensuring a lethal blow from a distance. He pulled the trigger. The pistol fired in silence, but he saw the muzzle flash and felt the recoil. He fired 10 rounds at the first target, then quickly replaced the magazine and fired another 10 rounds at the second target. Replacing the magazine again, he fired the last 10 rounds at the third target. 30 muzzle flashes. If anyone in the direction of Yellow River Station had been paying attention, they would have seen a firefly against the dark backdrop of space. Now the 30 meteorites were speeding toward their targets. The Type 2010 pistol had a muzzle velocity of 500 meters per second, so they would take around 10 seconds to cross the distance, during which Zheng Beihai could only pray that his targets did not change position. This hope wasn't groundless, because the two back rows had not yet gotten situated for the group photo, and even when they were all situated, the photographer had to wait until the mist sprayed out by the spacesuit thrusters dissipated, so the leaders in the front row had to wait. But since the targets were, after all, floating in space and weightless, they could easily drift, causing the bullets to not only miss their targets, but possibly hurt innocents. Innocent? The three people he was about to kill were innocent too. In the years before the Trisolar crisis, they had made what, looking back now, seemed like particularly meagre investments and had crept carefully over the thin ice toward the dawn of the space age. That experience had imprisoned their thinking. They had to be destroyed for the sake of interstellar-capable spacecraft. Their deaths could be viewed as their final contribution to the cause of humanity's endeavours in space. As a matter of fact, Zheng Beihai had deliberately sent a few bullets wide of the mark in the hope of hitting people other than his targets. Ideally, he would only wound them, but if he happened to kill an extra person or two, that didn't matter. That would only serve to reduce any potential suspicion. He lifted the empty gun and looked soberly through the scope. He was prepared for failure. In that eventuality, he would dispassionately begin the search for a second opportunity. Time passed second by second, and at last there were signs that a target had been hit. Zheng Beihai did not see the hole in the spacesuit, but a white gas spurted out. Immediately afterward, an even larger burst of white steam erupted from between the first and second rows, perhaps because the bullet had passed out the target's back and penetrated his thruster pack. He was confident of the bullet's power. When the meteorite projectiles struck their targets with practically no decrease in speed, it would be like being shot at gunpoint. Cracks suddenly appeared across the helmet visor of one target, rendering it opaque, but he could still see the blood that splashed up on the inside before mixing with leaking gases and spraying out of the bullet hole, where it quickly froze into snowflake-like crystals. His observations soon confirmed that five people, including the three targets, had been hit, and each target had been struck at least five times. Through their visors, he saw everyone in the crowd screaming in terror, and from the shape of their lips he knew that their words included the ones he was expecting. "Meteor shower!" Everyone in the photo group turned their thrusters to full power and sped back to the station, trailing tails of white mist behind them, and then they were through the round hatch and back inside Yellow River Station. Zheng Beihai saw that the five who had been hit were dragged back with them. He activated his own thruster pack and accelerated toward Base One. His heart was now as cold and calm as the empty space around him. He knew that the death of the three key aerospace figures did not guarantee that the non-media radiation drive would become the mainstream of spacecraft research, but he had done all he could. No matter what happened next, as far as the watchful eyes of his father in the beyond were concerned, he could now relax. At practically the same time as Zheng Beihai was returning to Base One, back on Earth's internet, a group of people hastily assembled in the wilderness of the virtual three-body world to discuss what had just happened.
"This time, the information transmitted via Sophon was very thorough, or we wouldn't have believed he actually did it,"
Qin Shi Huang said as he waved the sword about him in his uneasiness.
"Look at what he did, and then look at our three attempts on Luo Ji," he sighed. "Sometimes we're just too nerdy. We don't have that kind of cool competency."
"Are we just going to sit by and let him do this?" Einstein asked.
"In accordance with the Lord's intentions, that's all we can do. The man is an extremely stubborn holdout and a triumphalist, and the Lord doesn't want us to interfere unnecessarily with that type of human. Our attention must be focused on escapism. The Lord believes that defeatism is more dangerous than triumphalism, Newton said.
If we are to work sincerely and seriously in the service of the Lord, we can't wholly believe the Lord's strategy. After all, it's just the counsel of a child, Mo Tzu said. Qin Shi Huang knocked his sword on the ground.
Nevertheless, non-intervention is correct as far as this matter is concerned. Let them turn their development in the direction of radiation-drive spacecraft. With physics under Sofon lockdown, that will be a technological peak that's practically unsurpassable, not to mention a bottomless abyss into which humanity will pour all of their time and energy and end up with nothing.
We are agreed on this point, but I believe this man is critical. He's dangerous, von Neumann said.
Precisely, Aristotle said, nodding repeatedly.
We used to think he was a pure soldier. But is this the behaviour of a soldier who acts in accordance with strict discipline and rules?
He is indeed dangerous. His faith is rock solid. He's far-sighted and dispassionately ruthless, and he acts with calm resolve. Ordinarily, he's precise and serious. But when there's a need, he can go outside the lines and take extraordinary action, Confucius said with a sigh. Just like the first emperor said, this is the sort of person we lack.
He won't be hard to deal with. All we have to do is denounce his murders, Newton said.
It's not that simple,
Qin Shi Huang said, flipping a sleeve at him.
It's all your fault. You've been using the information you receive from the Sofons to sow discord in the Space Force and the UN. So how did this happen? Denunciation would be an honour or even a symbol of loyalty.
And we don't have any conclusive evidence, Mozart said. His plans were thorough. The bullets shattered when they hit, so any autopsy would retrieve only authentic meteorites from the bodies of the dead and wounded. Everyone is going to think they died in a meteor shower. The truth is so bizarre that no one would believe it.
It's a good thing he's going to reinforce the future. At least he won't be making trouble for us for a while.
Einstein let out a long sigh.
Gone. Everyone's gone. Some of us should go to the future, too.
Although they said they would meet again, everyone knew in their hearts that this was a final farewell. When the special contingent of future reinforcements headed to the hibernation center, Cheng Wei Se and a number of other senior Space Force generals came to the airport to see them off. He handed a letter to Zheng Beihai.
This letter is for my future successor. In it, I explain your circumstances and strongly recommend you to the Future Space Command. You'll awaken no sooner than 50 years in the future, possibly longer than that, at which time you may be faced with a more challenging work environment. You'll have to adapt to the future first, even as you preserve the spirit of the soldiers of our time. You must be cognizant of your working methods today and know which are obsolete and which should be carried on. This may turn out to be your greatest advantage in the future.
Zheng Beihai said, Commander, for the first time I feel a bit of regret that I'm an atheist. Otherwise, we'd have the hope of meeting again at some other time and place. Cheng Wei Se was a little taken aback at this sentiment coming from the ordinarily sober man, and the words resonated in the hearts of everyone else. But as soldiers, they kept the beating of their hearts deeply hidden.
I'm gratified that we've been able to meet in this lifetime. Be sure to greet our future comrades for us, Cheng Wei Se said.
After a final salute, the special contingent boarded the plane. Cheng Wei Sir's eyes did not leave Zheng Beihai's back for a moment. A steadfast soldier was leaving, and there might never be another like him. Where did his firm faith come from? The question had always lain hidden in the depths of his mind, and sometimes it even prompted a bit of jealousy. A soldier with faith in victory was fortunate. In the doomsday battle, those lucky people would be few and far between. As Zheng Beihai's tall frame disappeared inside the cabin door, Cheng Wei Sir had to admit that, up to the very end, he had never really understood him. The plane took off, carrying those who would perhaps have the chance to see humanity's final outcome, then disappeared behind thin, pale clouds. It was a bleak winter's day. The sun that shone listlessly behind a shroud of grey clouds and the chilly wind that blew across the empty airport gave the air the feel of solidified crystal, conjuring up the sense that the springtime might never really arrive. Cheng Wei Sir tightened the collar of his army coat. He turned 54 years old today, and in the dreary winter wind he saw his own end, and the end of the human race. Year 20, Crisis Era. Distance of the Trisolaran fleet from the solar system, 4.15 light-years. Ray Diaz and Hines were awakened from hibernation at the same time to the news that the technology they awaited had appeared. "So soon?" they exclaimed upon learning that just 8 years had passed. They were informed that due to unprecedented investment, technology had progressed with amazing speed over the past few years. But not everything was optimistic. Humanity was simply making a final sprint across the distance between them and the Sofon barrier, so the progress they were making was purely technological. Cutting-edge physics remained stopped up like a pool of stagnant water, and the reservoir of theory was being drained. Technological progress would begin to decelerate and eventually come to a complete halt. But for the time being, at least, no one knew when the end of technology would arrive. On feet that were still stiff from hibernation, Hines walked into a stadium-like structure whose interior was shrouded in a white fog, although it felt dry to him. He couldn't identify what it was. A soft moonlight glow illuminated the fog, which was fairly sparse at the height of a person, but grew dense enough up above that the roof was obscured. Through the fog he saw a petite figure whom he recognized at once as his wife. When he ran to her through the fog, it was like chasing a phantom, except that in the end they came together in an embrace.
"I'm sorry, love, I've aged 8 years," Keiko Yamasuki said.
"Even so, you're still a year younger than me," he said as he looked her over.
Time seemed to have left no mark on her body, but she looked pale and weak in the fog's watery moonlight. In the fog and moonlight, she reminded him of that night in the bamboo grove in their yard in Japan.
"Didn't we agree that you would enter hibernation 2 years after me? Why have you waited all this time?"
"I wanted to work on preparations for our post-hibernation work, but there was too much to do, so that's what I've been doing," she said as she brushed a strand of hair from her forehead.
"Was it hard?"
"It was very hard. 6 next-gen supercomputer research projects were launched not long after you went into hibernation. 3 of them employed traditional architecture, 1 used non-von Neumann architecture, and the other 2 were quantum and biomolecular computing projects. But 2 years later, the lead scientists of those 6 projects told me that the computing power we desired was impossible. The quantum computing project was the first to be terminated because it failed to find sufficient support in current theoretic physics. Research had run into the SOFON barrier. Next, the biomolecular project was discontinued. They said it was only a fantasy. The last to end was the non-von Neumann computer. Its architecture was actually a simulation of the human brain, but they said it was a shapeless egg that would never turn into a chicken. Only the three traditional architecture projects were still ongoing. But for a long time there was never any progress.
So that's it. I ought to have been with you the whole time.
It would have been no use. You only would have wasted 8 years. It was only recently, during a period of time when we were totally discouraged, that we came up with the crazy idea of simulating the human brain in a practically barbaric way.
And what was that?
To put the previous software simulation into hardware by using a microprocessor to simulate one neuron, letting all the microprocessors interact and allowing for dynamic changes to the connection model.
Hines thought about this for a few seconds, then realized what she meant.
Do you mean manufacturing 100 billion microprocessors?
She nodded.
That's practically the sum total of all the microprocessors that have been manufactured in human history.
I didn't run the numbers, but it's probably more than that.
Even if you really had all those chips, how long would it take to connect them all together?
Keiko Yamasuki smiled wearily. I knew it wasn't workable. It was just a desperate idea. But we really thought about doing it back then and making as many as we could. She pointed around her. This here is one of the 30 virtual brain assembly shops we had planned, but it's the only one that got built.
I really should have been here with you, Hines repeated with more emotion.
Fortunately, we still got the computer we wanted. Its performance is 10,000 times better than when you entered hibernation.
Traditional architecture?
Traditional architecture. A few more drops squeezed out of the lemon of Moore's Law. It astonished the computing community. But this time, my love, we've really come to the end.
A peerless computer.
If humanity failed, it would never be equaled, Hines thought, but did not say it out loud.
With this computer, research on the resolving imager became much easier.
Then she suddenly asked,
Love, do you have any idea of what 100 billion looks like?
When he shook his head, she smiled and stretched out her hands around her.
Look. This is 100 billion.
What?
At a loss for words, Hines looked at the white fog around him.
We're in the middle of the supercomputer's holographic display,
she said as she manipulated a gadget hanging at her chest. He noticed a scroll wheel on it and thought it might be something like a mouse. As she adjusted it, he felt a change in the surrounding fog. It thickened in what was clearly a magnification of a particular region. Then he noticed that it was made up of an uncountable number of tiny glowing particles, and these particles were emitting the moon-like illumination rather than scattering light from an outside source. As the magnification continued, the particles became shining stars, but instead of seeing the starry sky over Earth, it was like he was situated at the heart of the Milky Way, where the stars were dense and left practically no room for darkness.
Every star is a neuron, she said.
Their bodies were plated in silver by the ocean formed from 100 billion stars. As the hologram continued to enlarge, he noticed innumerable thin tentacles extending radially from every star to form intricate connections, wiping out the starfield and situating him inside an infinitely large network structure. The image enlarged further, and every star began to exhibit a structure that was familiar to him from electron microscopy, that of brain cells and synapses. She pressed the mouse and the image returned instantly to the white fog state. This is a full view of the structure of the brain captured using the resolving imager scanning 3 million cross-sections simultaneously. Of course, what we're seeing now is the processed image. For the convenience of observation, the distance between neurons has been magnified by 4 or 5 orders of magnitude, so it looks like we vaporized a brain. However, the topology of the connections between them has been preserved. Now let's take a look at a dynamic view. Disturbances appeared in the fog, glittering points in the mist that looked like a pinch of gunpowder sprinkled onto a flame. Keiko Yamasuki enlarged the image until it resembled a star field, and Hines saw the surging of star tide in a brain universe, the disturbances in the ocean of stars appearing in different forms at different locations, some like streams, others like vortexes, and others like the sweeping tides, all of it instantly mutable and giving rise to stunning pictures of self-organization within the teeming chaos. Then the image changed again to resemble a network, and he saw myriad nerve signals busily passing messages along thin synapses, like flashing pearls within the flow of an intricate network of pipes. "Whose brain is this?" he asked in wonder. "Mine," she said, looking lovingly at him. "When this thought picture was taken, I was thinking of you." Please note, when the light turns green, the 6th batch of test propositions will appear. If the proposition is true, press the right-hand button. If the proposition is false, press the left-hand button. Proposition 1. Coal is black. Proposition 2. 1 plus 1 equals 2. Proposition 3. The temperature in winter is lower than in summer. Proposition 4. Men are generally shorter than women. Proposition 5. A straight line is the shortest distance between 2 points. Proposition 6. The moon is brighter than the sun. The statements were displayed in succession on the small screen in front of the test subject. Each proposition was displayed for 4 seconds, and the subject pressed the left-hand or right-hand buttons according to his own judgment. His head was encased in a metal cover that allowed the resolving imager to capture a holographic view of his brain, which the computer would process into a dynamic neural network model for analysis. In this, the initial stage of Hines's research project, the subject engaged in only the simplest of critical thinking, and the test propositions had concise and clear answers. During such simple thoughts, the operation of the cerebral neural network was relatively easy to identify and provided a starting point for a more in-depth study of the nature of thought. The research teams, led by Hines and Keiko Yamasuki, had made some progress. They discovered that critical thinking was not produced in any specific location in the cerebral neural network, but used a particular mode of nerve impulse transmission, and that with the powerful computer's assistance, this model could be retrieved and located from among the vast network of neurons using a method quite similar to the star positioning the astronomer Rongier had provided to Luo Ji. Unlike finding a particular position pattern in a star field, in the universe of the brain the pattern was dynamic and was only identifiable by its mathematical characteristics. It was a little like looking for a small whirlpool in an expansive ocean, which meant that the computing power it required was many orders of magnitude greater than that of the star field, and was only feasible on this latest machine. Hines and his wife strolled through the cloud map of the brain in the holographic display. Every time a point of critical thinking was identified in the subject's brain, The computer would indicate its position on the image with a flashing red light. This was actually just a way to provide a more intuitive feast for the eyes and was not strictly required by the study. The important thing was the analysis of the internal structure of nerve impulse transmission at the point of thought. For there lay hidden the mysteries of the essence of the mind. Just then, the research team's medical director came in and said that Subject 104 was experiencing problems. When the resolving imager had just been developed, scanning such a huge quantity of cross-sections generated powerful radiation that was fatal to any life being scanned, but successive improvements had brought the radiation below the danger line, and a large number of tests had demonstrated that so long as filming was kept below a set length of time, the resolving imager would not cause any damage to the brain.
"He seems to have caught hydrophobia," the medical director said as they hurried toward the medical center.
Hines and Keiko Yamasuki stopped in their tracks in surprise. Hines stared at the medical director.
"Hydrophobia? Did he somehow get rabies?"
The medical director raised a hand and tried to sort out his thoughts.
"Oh, I'm sorry, that wasn't accurate. He doesn't have any physical problems, and his brain and other organs have not been damaged at all. It's just that he's afraid of the water, like someone with rabies. He refuses to drink, and he won't even eat moist food. It's an entirely psychological effect. He just believes that water is toxic."
"Persecutory delusion?" Keiko Yamasuki asked. The medical director waved a hand.
No, he doesn't think that anyone put poison in the water. He just believes the water itself is toxic."
Again, Hines and his wife stopped still, and the medical director shook his head helplessly.
"But psychologically, he's completely normal in every other way. I can't explain it. You've got to see it for yourselves."